You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here, on my right, we've got Martin Page. Martin, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mike, and we are rolling. At last, we are rolling. I won't say any more, but we're rolling.
Good, don't say any more. Next to him, we've got Bobby Osiski.
Hey,
Bobby.
Mike. Hey, everybody. We're rolling, yes. We seem to be.
And finally, across the way, we have the one and only Iron Man of the Audio Nowcast, Mr. Rob. Yeah. I've never missed a podcast.
That's true.
Arbiter, Rob.
Hello, Mike. Right. We are, in fact, rolling.
And today, joining us on the panel, we have a terrific guest from one of the greatest microphone companies in the world. We are, well, honored to have with us John Jennings from Royer Microphones.
All right, John.
Hey, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here, and I'm tremendously proud to know we are rolling.
Okay.
Well, the three of us are.
What are they rolling?
Yes, we had a couple of technical problems before we started.
With microphones as well. And we could have had some Royer.
I'm telling you.
Wait, we're riding some Royer.
But it's not like we've been doing this for 7 years or anything. Actually, guys, this is show number 133, our first show of year 8.
Yeah, right.
Very cool.
We've survived.
And before we get going, I just want to mention a few things. Number one, you know what? We've gotten a really great response to our API giveaway. And this is going to be the last podcast that will accept entries. So it's not too late to enter for the API lunchbox. And let me tell you, we've gotten some entries, but believe me, you have a great chance. So I really encourage you to enter for the API lunchbox and the 560 EQ module, which is my absolute favorite API module. It's so handy. You can do all kinds of stuff. It's a graphic. It's really cool. So, and then I also want to say thank you. We've gotten some fantastic letters. I forwarded a couple of them to all the guys in the podcast.
Yeah, they were really cool.
Yeah.
You guys are great. I mean, it's really good to get that kind of feedback from you guys. I mean, we do this and we know a lot of you guys are busy and you don't have a lot of time. And the fact that we can get feedback from you, even it's just, you know, hey, you're doing a good job, or hey, I like to listen to you in the car, stuff like that. I mean, it's really great. It really, you know, we feel like we're talking to people, and that's what's important. So I just want to thank you guys, and I want to encourage you to enter. Send us the email, audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And, you know, send us a little note along with it. It's really good. Really good to get some feedback. So taking care of that, let's start into it. There's a lot that has happened, a lot that I want to talk about. And right off the bat, every once in a while, you witness a paradigm shift. You witness something changing. And guys, last week, I think we saw another paradigm shift. And that is the new MacBook Pro. And it's not so much the fact that the MacBook Pro is small and the fact that the MacBook Pro has you know, no slots into it. The fact that we're kind of seeing the death of the add-in card, you know, it's going to take a different form factor. It's no longer going to go inside your machine. It's going to go outside your machine. And I just really quick wanted to open it up to you guys. I mean, what do you think? Do you think, you know, good move, smart move from Apple? Was it inevitable? Bobby O, what do you think about that?
Smart move. Personally, I always hated slots anyway, anything that was in there. And you don't need them because Thunderbolt 2 is faster than PCI, so it works just fine. Good, you know, they've always been ahead of the curve, getting rid of the CD player and DVD player, things like that. And they're ahead of the curve now, getting rid of internal slots.
Rob, what did you think when you saw that?
Well, I mean, I think for most consumers, I mean, remember, the audio world is a very small sliver of what goes on in the universe. For most of the universe, I think it's a really good move. I mean, for the audio world, I think it's going to be a while before everything you want to do, you can do over Thunderbolt 2. So you're going to be buying chassis, and it's actually going to drive the costs up for a while, just like other changes in slots when we went from, you know, PCI to PCIe and all these things. It takes a while for the hardware manufacturers, which don't have the deep pockets of Apple, takes a while for them to retool their technology to be able to work over Thunderbolt or whatever. So in the short term, it's actually going to, I think, mean things are more expensive. In the long run, it makes sense because it's horrible to have to mess with cards inside a chassis. I mean, if you've ever been in a studio and had to get to the PCI cards to reseat something in the middle of a session, you never want to have to do that again.
You know, we're running out of slots.
Yeah, yeah. Matter.
But, you know, do you really think it's going to raise the price? I think it's just going to shift. It's going to shift to whatever manufacturer is on the bandwagon.
If you have a bunch of Pro Tools cards right now and you want to run them with the new machine, you're going to have to buy an expensive chassis where you didn't have to with your old Mac Tower. That's all.
Yeah, but the good thing is the new Pro Tools isn't going to support most of your old cards anyhow. Except
well,
the
HDX cards.
Yeah. I mean
I'm just saying for some users,
yeah.
For me personally, it's going to be more expensive because I'm going to be ripping a lot of cards out of machines. And the jury's out yet to see the Thunderbolt 2 chassis, how many slots will they have. You know, there were a lot of people who had 7-card systems who could only run 6 cards
yeah.
with one generation of chassis. It just adds some complexity. I think in the long run it makes sense because having to disassemble a machine to change hardware is a pain in the butt.
Yeah.
I do sort of wish there were like better military spec connectors or something that could make using a Mac like the new tower or whatever it's called, the cylinder, to be able to use that in a professional environment. You know, Thunderbolt cables and USB cables and all those kinds of cables, they're all really kind of flimsy and they're not really designed for heavy industrial use. And I look forward to
someday.
It's not
the cables, it's the connectors.
The connectors yeah. is what I mean, yeah. I mean, it would be nice that if there was a solution that was a little more robust, at least when you had your cards in your chassis.
Yeah, they locked
in. They were secure, they locked in.
I will absolutely give you that. Sometimes my Thunderbolt, I plug it in and out all the time, and sometimes it has a tendency of getting loose.
Yeah, they're not meant to take that.
So it's
are military versions of those connectors, too, that people don't realize. They could have actually changed that. Just like even in the ADAT light pipe days, there was the cheapo light pipe on the back of your ADAP, but there was a military-grade yeah. optical connector that was actually really good. It's just it was expensive, so no one used it.
Well, having said that, though, if you're in a home or a studio environment where it's just going to sit there, once you plug it in, it's pretty good. As long as you're not doing a lot of plug-ins and plug-outs, it's pretty
yeah,
good.
Yeah, that's part of the users.
John, what did you think about the announcements and the new Mac Pro?
Well, of course, I went to their website and sort of looked at their deconstruction of the thing, and I thought it was beautiful. I mean, they sort of lift the chassis and look inside there, see what's going on. It looked beautifully put together. I like the cooling coming up the center of it. I like the in and outs. I see that. I'm a Mac fan. I mean, I had a MacBook Pro for about 4 years that I really liked. And then I got one about 5 months ago, and it's light years ahead of the other one that I had. I mean, the advancements, got the solid drive in it and that Retina screen. And I think that Mac is driving so much change and they're bringing the quality up so quickly. That I'm a Mac fan, and I like what I saw.
I will say, by the way, because so much of my life, and it's funny because I used to be the diehard PC guy, but
I was too.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of us made that transition. My entire world now, when I'm traveling, I carry 3 MacBook Pros. I carry 2 17s of the last generation, and I carry one of the 15 Retinas. And I got to tell you, because the Retina machine is so busy with the extra graphics work, the 17s beat it. I mean, for most of what I'm doing, run a QuickTime capture of a live video on the Retina machine versus an old 17 and tell me which is smoother. It's not even close. I realize it's because the Retina machine has some more components that don't use as much power and it's busy with a lot more pixels to keep track of.
Now, but that won't be the case with the Mac Pro because apparently the graphics card on it is powerful enough to drive 3 4K monitors at the same time.
They have the latest ATI.
That will be way faster than any laptop.
Yeah.
I'm just saying in the laptop world, if you actually A and B the previous generation with the new one, unless you need the Retina. I mean, I like the Retina for certain things. I basically bought the Retina machine, though, because I couldn't get any more of these 17s. If I could have gotten a third one of these.
Really? I've got a 17. You want to swap?
Let's talk after the show. But I think Apple, in a lot of ways, they add features that need a ton more power, and then they add a lot more power, but the ending user experience doesn't end up being that much better.
Well,
you know, I have to say that my user experience is this. I was a Dell guy for years, but I found that my MacBook Pro, working with Parallels is running the PC apps better than the PC ever ran it.
Yeah.
And I was just on a plane coming back from Germany a couple months ago. I worked on this thing for about 8 hours, and I still had 25, 26% battery, which I could never get before. Even out of the last MacBook Pro, I'd swap a battery, and then I'd still I get about 5 hours total. This thing with this Retina display, I kind of dialed it down a little bit because the screen's using some power, but you dial it back to about half brightness, it's plenty to work with on a plane, and I got 8 hours out of that thing. I still had
the battery life is great.
I think the new Mac Pros are going to be really cool because of the size, because they're so small, and you'll be able to do some really cool render farms, really cool networking, there's going to be some really powerful applications to use with a bunch of these things. I mean, if you can think of a server farm with a bunch of these in a rack, and it's not going to take a lot of space. A lot of people are saying, well, you know, it's round, and you know, if you really were thinking about that, you'd make something square so that you can stack them. But I think the round form factor of it is kind of genius, because it allows you to put them close enough so that there's always air. They're never going to be like on top of each other. If you put them next to each other, there's always going to be places for air, because they're, you know, it being round, they're only going to connect in one small little point. So it's actually pretty cool.
Well, I guarantee there are already companies making, you know, designing rack, you know, chassis and stuff where you can mount a bunch of these things.
But it's perfect for your donuts too.
But you know what? I will say it's going to be like, for instance, me and Martin, we're putting together his new studio, and for the longest time, we were like, at the end of last year, we're like, okay, we're ready to go. Mm-hmm. And Martin's saying, well, let's just give it a little bit of time. And then I was saying, let's just give it a little time. Basically waiting for this announcement. And now that we know what this announcement is, it's going to work out really good for a studio like Martin's. We're going to run Thunderbolt on it. We're going to have, you know, 32 IO with two, you know, 16 channel,
But you're not going to mess with HDX cards, right?
No. And it's going to be cheaper, and it's going to be better than what he has right now.
I like the sound of that. Cheaper. But, that's the killer
but
word.
Here's the thing. You know, talking about Pro Tools, you would think that having the inclination that they did, that the cards are on the way out, which, you know, for them, the day after that announcement, I got a phone call from a friend of mine who's a salesman, and he said that I was saying, oh, hey, how about the announcement? And he was going, man, it just killed him, because there were a lot of Pro Tools deals that he's working on that now are a whole different ballgame, because people don't want to buy the cards. They want to buy – he's trying to say, no, now's the time to buy the 12-core because we still have them. They're not going to be around forever, so get it. And they're like, because they're just reluctant to buy into something that in their mind is a dead end. And I can't blame them. I can't blame that. But having said that, you would think that Avid would have a more elegant solution to Thunderbolt than what they have. The way they have it right now, where you have to go Thunderbolts to that little box, and then from that box to your interface, that's a great solution if you want to add more interfaces. But why don't they have a native Thunderbolt? I mean, if Apollo could do it, why couldn't DigiDesign? I mean, why couldn't Avid do it? That, to me, is just – it's just another one of those Avid things that just kind of frustrates the bejeebies out of me, you know?
Well, they're probably thinking about it now.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, but look, they probably have a whole – I mean, who knows what their stock is like on all these cards. And these cards are not cheap, you know, thousands of – you can get one with an interface. You know, you can get in on the $6,000. But then you try buying your second one or try going up from there, it's some major bucks.
But Mike, Avid's in trouble.
I know. I can see why.
financially, stock-wise, and they've lost so many of their R&D people. They've lost so many of their people in general. People are jumping as quickly as they can. And I can name three companies where they just scarfed up all of the best Avid people.
Well,
The execs, the salespeople, you know, R&D people, engineers.
Yeah. It just in some ways it kind of breaks my heart that they're not taking advantage of this, because I would like to have a audio interface that goes one cable Thunderbolt straight into an Avid something. That is something they could sell. You know, it doesn't have to be cheap. It just has to be good. You know, if you have that box and everybody's selling their interfaces for $2,000, sell it for $4,000. That's fine. It just has to be good, because to me, it's worth paying that price to get something with that kind of functionality in it. you know, I don't understand some of these decisions, because right now, you know who's looking really good is Universal Audio on the Apollo. I mean, those guys look like geniuses. They just came out with their 16
it's stackable too.
Yeah, their 16-channel version that's stackable that has the DSP. You know, it has DSP just like an Avid card. It's not the equivalent of an Avid card, but you know, it has built-in DSP. It has 16 I/O. It runs their own plugin, so they have their own universe where they have their own store. They're like the new Avid, and it's like we were saying when we first started this podcast that, you know, companies are going to come and go. You're going to see the cycle. Different ones are going to rise and other ones are going to fall, you know, and it's just unfortunate that, you know, a company that kind of built digital audio, you know, on the pro level is making some of these decisions. I mean, I don't know. Rob, what do you think?
Well,
or maybe Rob can't talk.
No, Rob can't talk. I think, you know, most of the time this competition is really healthy for everybody because everybody's forced to innovate. The problem is Avid has lost so many people that kind of dynamic doesn't still work when you don't actually have the teams and the, you know, what you need to innovate.
Yeah.
So the problem is because Pro Tools is still the 800-pound gorilla. I mean, the Universal Audio stuff is great, but a lot of people are using it to run – you know, with Pro Tools.
Right.
So if Avid actually falls apart, that's not a good thing for Universal Audio or anybody. And so that's what sort of scares me about the state of
Avid
right now.
No, I'm with you. I mean, don't get me wrong. I rail on Avid because I love Avid.
Let me just ask you, because I'm not out of the picture here. Why are Avid struggling? Why are they lost to all these good people?
Management.
Yeah, management.
Management.
I just think, yeah, management.
Well, no, I'll tell you exactly why. Because Avid bought Digi. Digi's strong. Digi's actually the strongest part and is keeping him alive. Avid, in terms of the video part, which is, you know, of course, what they do, they've been killed by Final Cut and recently Premiere.
More by Premiere. Yeah, I mean, Apple did.
Apple didn't help themselves. That's true, yeah.
Apple did them a favor by sort of screwing up Final Cut.
But they didn't take advantage of it. That's the big problem.
Well, and the funny thing is with the video is, you know, I work at a big video place and we've got, you know, 80 edit suites or some ridiculous thing like that. In a heartbeat, if they were priced a little better, a little more friendly, we would change back because of what happened with Final Cut. We would absolutely change back to Avid. As a matter of fact, we're slowly putting in Avid Bays in, but they
Well, the problem there is Apple didn't need to make money off Final Cut, but Avid needs to.
Right.
Off a Media Composer. So it's hard to compete with someone who doesn't need to make any money from their product.
But to not price yourself, I mean, when it comes to digital products, though, you need to be really aggressive in that because you're not carrying an inventory, you know. So,
well, but Media Composer, they dropped the price like crazy,
right? But it's still compared to where everybody else is. When you can buy a Premiere Suite, you know, that can do pretty much just as much.
Yeah,
you know?
But here's the difference, though. See, Avid never made and Digi never made the money off software. It's always been hardware,
right?
Yeah.
And with Premiere and with, you know, Adobe, you're talking about software primarily. It's a completely different story. And the markup is so much greater that you have on software than on hardware.
Which, I mean, you know, they're kind of reaping what they're sowing because the shift is way more digital, less physical card, physical product, because your machine is getting more and more powerful. You can offload a lot of the stuff you had to offload onto a card. You don't have to offload anymore. You can do it in your machine. It's I don't know. It's just really interesting to see where this is all going, and it's going to affect people like Martin, you know, as he's putting together his new studio. And
part of what bugs me about all this is, you know, the technology advances and there's all the stuff that's really cool, but then there are things that are less cool that everybody just kind of says, well, it's okay that's less cool. And one of those to me is tracking through plugins and latency. You know, like the HDX world and what the TDM world was, that was a huge reason to get the hardware.
Yeah, no, I agree.
You know, if you're tracking a live band and you need to track them through plugins and there's a delay, that's a showstopper.
It's still a reason to use HDX.
I know it is, but that's one of those things. You know, everybody's going to be all excited about these new machines and not needing the hardware, but the truth is the hardware still gets you something. It's not that it has no value.
I can't believe anybody would even consider tracking through plugins to begin with. I don't care what the latency is. I don't care how low it is. I just don't see the value of that.
Well, if you don't have the outboard gear, it's better than having nothing. I mean,
okay, I'm old school. you know, in my old school train of thought, you don't need that. You don't have to do it.
But if you're trying to put a limiter on the bass and you don't have a physical limiter,
sure,
and you have a good plug.
But having said that, you know, there are, if it's an AAX plugin, it's gonna, even on a non-HDX, your latency is gonna be pretty easy, pretty manageable. I'm not going to say it's zero, but it's going to be like 1 or 2 milliseconds. It's not that much at all. I can use the channel strip and track through that, and it's not going to, you know, it's not going to mess up your time, and it's not enough for a guitar player who's picking apart to notice.
Not if it's a millisecond.
And, okay, wait a second. So, John, you're a guitar player.
Right.
Do you know when latency bothers you?
I can feel it. I know but I don't know when it is. I don't know at what point latency bothers me. I just know when it bothers me.
Can you still play?
I'd have to take a headphone off, get an ear off.
Okay.
You know, it's not a huge problem.
I hate it. I mean, whenever I hear it, I track like you were saying through old school, just through my Teletronics. That's the only real kind of limiting I do. I go straight down without anything on it, and then I play with it after. Very rarely do I record anything. Unless it's analog outside, where my microphone, as we're talking now, is going through an analog limiter like a Teletronics. I don't like recording with the software on it, because I like to get, like you say, everything down pretty straightforward. Even if I'm using guitars, it's going through an amplifier and a few pedals on the floor, and I'll hit it. It'll be an outside compressor, not a compressor that's coming through the computer. I have tried it, and it really bothers me.
I had the great advantage of being around Dave Royer and Rick Prodan and a number of people who are what you would call old school. And so I've always tracked that way. Mm-hmm. You know, very rarely. I can't remember ever tracking through plugins.
You know, I think this is because I came from that school. So whenever anybody said you could track with all the plugins, I was like, well, why?
Get it right with the mic and free.
It made me start choosing things, you know, and thinking I would never do this if I was singing anyway. You know, it's like you start to get all these little Walt Disney gimmicks. That's how it appeared to me when I first started to play with Pro Tools.
And I will say that Martin, since his music is a lot of feel, he can sense latency.
Oh, ridiculous, yeah.
Really fast, because I get the phone calls.
We figured out years ago that it was about 7 milliseconds for keyboards that became the problem, which, as it turns out, I think was the same latency that was built into a DX7. So I guess Yamaha knew that when it got that tight, that was good enough. But yeah, about 7 milliseconds. Like whenever I was designing patches for Stevie and systems for him, I was used to measure. And if I could do 7 milliseconds or better, I would not usually hear a complaint.
Really? He didn't have a problem with that, huh?
No. 7 was fine. I mean, even for drum stuff, it was close enough. I mean, he was always very forgiving because he could ignore it if he was hearing it. I mean, you could have a half a second latency and he could just ignore it. But that's just his personal skill. But
the guys at Line 6 told me that when they first came out with the Pod Pro, that they had a lot of trouble with people that could hear 3 that were just bitching and moaning. And these were pros,
right,
you know, for the most part. And, boy, I don't get that.
I've never known anyone who could hear 3. I mean, for a vocal, like maybe if you're hearing yourself flange a little bit.
But three milliseconds.
That's kind of crazy.
But you know what, though? I could see a guitar player, especially a guitar player that does picking, they're so used to the attack hitting their ears at a certain time. And I think that's – even if they don't necessarily hear it, they can just tell something is up with the attack. Because when you pick and when you're playing and you're picking, you know, you hear – not only do you hear what the attack is through your headphones, but you kind of feel it on the string too, and you just know what that needs to be at. And the second that comes, you know, flams just a little bit, then it just – it just throws them off, you know?
I mean, there's some number that people can hear, and you know, if it's longer than that, you hear it, and if it's shorter than that, you don't.
42 milliseconds.
It's probably different for each person.
42 milliseconds.
42 milliseconds.
42 milliseconds. 42.
You can grasp it.
The Haas effect, 40 milliseconds.
Yeah. What is the Haas effect?
That's the point where you begin to hear an echo.
Gotcha.
And lower than that, you don't. It depends. Certain textbooks say it's 30, others say it's 40, but in that general neighborhood.
Well, you know, all that to say is times are changing. I think the whole latency thing is, as software gets written better and things are happening in that end, I think it's It's going to be a problem at first, but I think it's going to work itself out as your computers start getting
Well, that's actually more a function of CPU speed. Yeah. So the fact that these new machines are that much faster, I forget, the new Mac Pro is like 2.5 times faster than...
It's 100 million gigahertz.
Yeah. It's a bazillahertz.
It's a bazillahertz.
But, you know, it does... It is basically how fast the computer can pipe things through the CPU and process them. So as the computers get faster, the latency can't help but go down. Yeah. But, you know, it's going to be everybody's...
But wait, no, wait. There's that, and there's also the buffer, because you have to have a buffer in order to keep the digital stream even.
Right, but the buffer can be smaller if the CPU is faster.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
And, you know, on the other hand, too, is when you talk all about this CPU and you talk about, you know, one machine, you know, we're getting to the point where maybe your studio is not going to be one machine. Maybe your studio is going to be two machines. I mean, depending on how much this thing costs, maybe we're going to see some really interesting networking and configurations.
If they get into like a Thunderbolt cascading networking kind of thing where you can actually like share processing power, I have no idea if this is in the plans.
Right,
but it seems like things would be moving that way. That would be cool. I mean, the limiting factor, all of the bus speeds to the memory and all that are way faster than anybody needs for any kind of reasonable audio project.
I mean, there's no reason why you can't set up your own mini cloud inside your own studio, whatever that looks like. For instance, we're designing Martin Studio, and for the price of, you know, the 10 grand for the car, let's say we could buy 2 or 3 of these little machines. We can all link them together. So no matter where he is in his different recording environments, they're all kind of functioning at one.
The Martin Cloud.
The Martin Cloud. I like the sound of that.
But seriously, that there's some possibilities on thinking on your computing side that –
The issue with that is always how do you fly all the audio around? Like if you want to be able to have 64 channels of audio or 128 going around, the computer becomes most busy handling all of that stuff.
Yeah, but I mean with the processing power that's coming out, I just think it's going to be – it used to be how would you handle HD video. And now it's, you know,
how many streams
you want.
Do we know how much is this going to cost yet or they haven't?
No, they haven't. Okay. It's probably going to be, you know – I would imagine it's going to be more expensive than your standard computer, but it's going to be at various levels, you know, where you can add RAM and disk drives and stuff like that.
Well, they should come do it at like $24.95
is the entry. Yeah, I was going to say
$24.95 for the entry and $34.95 for the cooler.
Yeah.
But the thing is, there's actually, you know, there's a lot of R&D in it, but they don't have the massive, robust power supply. I mean, it could be that it's actually cheaper to build. I don't know.
Yeah.
And it's being built in America, right? Isn't it?
That's right.
That's
right.
That's a big deal. That's a big deal.
So anyhow,
it's going to cost 12 grand, but it's going to be beautiful.
Well, I'll tell you what. You know, it's just interesting. I would say keep your eyes open. Right now in the digital audio world, it's exciting and scary at the same time. It's exciting because there's
Mike,
some –
Mike, you said this is the big change, right?
We're going to go through a cardless – You know, we're going to a cardless universe. You know, you're not going to see those, you know, PCIe cards anymore, and you're not going to see. Well, you know, I bet you Abbott has a fire sale somewhere down the road. But seriously, you're not. That's not going to be the focus anymore. You're going to see something else. I don't know what that is. I don't know what that looks like. The cool thing about it, though, is this: you buy your little tower, and you buy a Thunderbolt interface, and then you buy your hard drive, and then somebody comes out with something cooler, you know, replace your Thunderbolt with a different Thunderbolt version. Oh, you replace your CPU because now there's a better one that came around that you want. I mean, it really makes it modular, and you really don't have to do the whole, oh, they just changed standard on me, so I no longer can use
my cars won't work.
In the new version, you know?
Well, for a little while, it's going to be really good to be a chassis manufacturer.
Oh, absolutely.
You know,
Magma chassis. Those guys are going to just rake it in, you know? They have – theirs works with the HDX cards, you know?
Because you think about like – I mean, Scott Gershon's not here, but you imagine on a stage like
– I know.
He works where they'll have 12 rigs going and each one has 64 outs or whatever.
Yeah.
And you know how you're going to do that with, you know, tray after tray of little cylinders with a million Thunderbolt cables hanging out, going to a million different interfaces. I mean, it's going to be messy and you just wonder how that's all going to –
work out at the high pro end.
Although, having said that, you read RME, they're like, you know what, we're going full bore into development of the Thunderbolt products. And
they're the ones to do it.
And they are. They are smart cookies. I mean, RME, they make some great interfaces. They're not cheap. They don't have to be cheap because they're really, really good. So it's just an exciting time. It's scary, exciting. If you're going to spend some money, you know, I wouldn't spend on yesterday's. You know, look for the future. Don't look back. And you know, we'll see what happens. I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break right now. And then when we come back, we're going to talk microphones. We're going to talk with John about Royer and just a couple other little things. So we will see you on the other side.
Listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were talking about how Avid's going out of business. No.
Hopefully not.
No, they're not. But
if they do, you're going to be saying, I predicted it that day. No. I predicted it.
No, it'll be interesting to see what happens, where it all ends up. Like I said, we're in a precarious little time. It's good for some companies, not so good for others. But hey, we're going to switch channels right now. We're going to go from the digital world. We're going to go to completely analog. And you cannot get more analog than a good microphone. And we're here with John from Royer. And John, I went on your website. I read the Royer story. It was really cool. Why don't you tell us a little about Royer Microphones, a little bit about the history of the company.
Sure. It's an interesting company. Taking it way back, I moved out to L.A. for a music deal that didn't pan out. But a friend of mine met this interesting microphone genius who was doing these microphone mods and building pre's and compressors and things. And it was Dave Royer. And we thought we'd start a company with Dave doing condenser mics and pre's and compressors. And we didn't know enough about business to make a good stab at it. And you know, that company lasted 10 or 11 months. But during that time, Dave was always talking about ribbon mics. And nobody was interested, myself included, until I read an article one day where Eddie Kramer talked about always having a ribbon mic on Jimi Hendrix's guitar cabinet, which really got my interest. I'm going, oh, really? And that night on the way home, I turned on the radio, and it was right on top of that great guitar solo in Third Stone from the Sun. Mm. And it just blew my mind. I kind of had a religious conversion and went in the next day and started talking to Dave about ribbons. And of course, you know, Dave is a genius. He's a really interesting guy. He was born autistic, didn't speak until he was six, and his parents used to play classical music in the house, and he just loved it—classical and ethnic folk music from different parts of the country or different parts of the world—and he was soaking all that up. And then later became, you know, really adept with electronics. He's one of those guys who can just take an extraordinary focus, as happens with a number of people with autism. And putting his love of music together with his interest in electronics and that knowledge he gained, he was able to put together some really wonderful sounding stuff. But he always thought that the ribbon was the most organic sounding of all the microphone types. And so when we started that conversation about ribbons, the first company went its natural course. We were out of business pretty quickly. But we met a wonderful guy, Rick Parada, who had started Matchless Guitar Amplifiers in his living room with Mark Sampson. He also had a studio back in the 80s called Babio, which was a pretty successful L.A. studio. Guy had great business chops and extraordinary production chops, and we put our heads together, and Rick brought in Rafael Viafane, who financed the company. And Dave Royer showed up one day with the first R-121, which I keep in my desk drawer. And he said, guys, you think we can sell these? And the first place that mic went was out to Joe Barisi. And the mic didn't have a name, but he put that mic up on a band that didn't have a name at that point and said, yeah, it sounds pretty good on the guitars. And that mic became the 121, and the band became Queens of the Stone Age.
Hmm.
So it was an interesting little historical start there for both of them. But it's interesting that we were talking so much about the digital side of things, because one of the reasons that Royer did as well as we did in the early days was that A ribbon microphone hears things more like the human ear does than any other kind of mic.
Right.
And it's an extremely simple signal. A ribbon mic is a very simple signal. It's not so much what ribbons do, it's what they don't do. There's a lot of things that they don't do, and we'll spend a little more time on that. But when we first launched Royer, we took Dave's design and Rick, you know, built this production technique that, you know, makes them what they are today. They're very well-built, solid mics. You put them up in a digital system. It sounded so analog. We had Steve Kempster and Al Schmidt and some other guys going, I just feel like I'm back on tape again. You know, now these were in the earlier days where the converters weren't as good.
Right.
And, you know, they were giving you a lot more trouble than you're having today.
Yeah.
But back then, harshness or sibilance and you know, accentuated high end was just driving you nuts because there were a lot of other things that were happening inside these converters that just weren't any fun. We take a ribbon signal, and the lack of self-distortion and the lack of, you know, high-frequency peaks and bumps and very even roll-off right around where the human ear starts to roll that things out. And it just, you know, you track with that thing and kind of feel like you were rolling 2-inch again.
Right.
Which had a lot to do with the success of the company.
Can I just interrupt you for one quick second?
Sure.
Can you explain to people out there just the difference between a ribbon microphone, how it, you know, the physical differences between that and like a condenser and like a dynamic, just so we can have a ground base?
Sure. Just briefly think about a condenser and look at the capsule that's inside it. Anybody can look at their condenser mic and you see that round capsule. You've got a membrane stretched over a backplate, and it's kind of like look at a snare drum. You're tightened all the way around there. You've got clamping that keeps that thing at a certain tension, and it responds to whatever you throw at it. But it's fairly tight, and it's going to, a capsule is going to resonate. Its resonance point is going to be at about a kilohertz, 1K. A ribbon, well, let's go with the dynamic first. You get a dynamic microphone is generally built around a spring system, a coil that's got to move a lot of mass. So it doesn't have great transient response, and it doesn't pick up a lot of nuance, but it's great for live use because it's very rugged, and it's great for things like a kick drum where you just want that big woof. So dynamics really have their place. Ribbon microphones, you basically have a corrugated aluminum ribbon element, which is hung by two sides, the top and the bottom. The thing is generally anywhere from an inch to an inch and a half long. And you know, you can hang it without being corrugated, but then as sound hits it, it really can't move. You want this thing to move kind of like a slinky. So you corrugate it, and it's got some motion. But because it's hung so loosely, hung in space, the resonance point of a ribbon is about 40 hertz. That's way down in the basement. You get subtle phase shifts at the resonance point. So, you know, you have these issues that engineers have to deal with in condensers where you're resonated at 1K. You don't have to deal with any of that with something that's so low down in the audio range. So this aluminum element is hung in a magnetic field, a very strong magnetic field. Now, when you look at the old mics, you look at the RCA 44s, that's a 7-pound microphone.
Hmm.
The reason for that is you have these you have 2 3-pound magnets that you needed to hang at the top and the bottom to generate enough magnetic juice so that when that aluminum moved a little bit in there, it would generate a little juice, would generate a little electricity. These days, you have neodymium magnets, which are far stronger.
Right.
And you can put, you know, an ounce and a half of neodymium magnets in there and get as much power as you got out of, you know, 6 pounds of magnets in a 44.
Wow.
So you're generating, you're concentrating a lot of magnetic energy onto this aluminum ribbon. And the way this works is when a non-magnetic metal moves in a magnetic field, you generate a little electricity. And that's what happens with a ribbon. As any sort of sound, as any sort of sound pressure hits it, you get a response. And the nuances that ribbons are able to respond to, because they're hung so loosely, it's pretty extraordinary. They can respond to anything. They have a fantastic transient response, and you know, you really hear that. They sound very natural.
I always think when you think ribbon microphones, you think of any kind of signal that would be harsh. You put a ribbon up there, it kind of just gives it a really smooth feel. I mean, like a brass section or like a guitar cabinet or something. I mean, there's something very analog and very smooth about ribbon microphones. But Bobby, where would you suggest, you know, using ribbon microphones, you know, and what are some places you like to use ribbon microphones?
Well, John can speak to this more because he's seen it on everything, but you know, brass for sure. The R121 has become almost a standard anymore on guitar cabs. You see that everywhere. Vocals, you know, they're nice on vocals if you use them right, because if you don't, you know, you can have some problems, but they do sound good. And
the trick is just don't let the singer blow into it. Yes. That's right. Yeah. And I remember the first time I met John. The first time I met John, he said, that's the one thing that'll kill a ribbon mic.
Right. You can put it up on a heavy guitar cab for years, but give it to a 2-year-old. That's, you know, it's like, oh, man.
Well,
you
know? John, tell us, what are some of the better uses of a ribbon microphone?
Well, the best uses of a ribbon are when you have something in front of you that you want to capture that sound. Now, you're not always looking to capture that sound. I'll give you a couple examples. You know, with pop vocals, you're looking for some more high-end cut to get through a track. If you track that voice very naturally, it's going to sound kind of dull. It's not going to sit there properly.
Right.
Or like in an orchestra, you track a harp. It could sound very full and natural, but it might blend too much. You might want to put condensers on that to get more glitz out of it. But you know, electric guitar, a lot of guitarists are terribly frustrated because you have a great amp, you have a great guitar, you got all this power, you know, just blowing your pant legs and feeding back and sounding so wonderful, and you put a mic on it and go in the control room and you might as well just have plugged into a rat pedal and a little MXR compressor. But with a good ribbon, you'll get the sound of that amp in the room.
What about drums?
Fantastic on drums. You get all that power. Ribbons as drum overheads are great, but if you're used to condensers, and again, that's something where you might want a condenser to make the cymbals ride, to make them really stand out more, to make them more rock and roll, more bright and in your face. But you can open up 12K with a ribbon mic and get those cymbals to be more bright and flashy, but really get the power of the drum set.
So were you guys the first for the ribbons, or were ribbons made before you lot?
Well, you had ribbons in the 30s, 40s, 50s. Those were the mics.
Yeah.
You know, you can look at old pictures of Elvis Presley and Frank Sinatra and B.B. King, and they're all singing and playing on ribbons.
So they went out of fashion to a certain degree, then, you guys?
Mm-hmm.
They went out of fashion in the 60s.
Okay.
Early 60s. And the only ribbons that were still being built were the Coles 4038 and the Biodynamic M160. And I think there was another Biodynamic that was being built. But not selling very much. Wes Dooley of AEA was carrying the flag, selling the 4038s, and he also makes these wonderful recreations of the old RCA mics. Mm-hmm. He was the guy to send them to, him and Clarence Kane and a few other folks who really knew the ribbon stuff. Mm-hmm. But Wes did a beautiful job of you know, restoring these mics and then actually building copies of the 44s and 77s. But there were no new designs until Dave Royer cooked up the 121. In 1997, and it's a completely different kind of a mic. Your old ribbons were fairly fragile, fairly heavy. If you put them in front of a guitar cab, you could watch the confetti of the ribbon flying out the back. You know, like, whoa, what did you do to that?
are they delicate in any way? Do you really have to look after them in a certain way? I've heard that you've got to hang them up a certain way after you've used them, and all these different rumors. And so maybe you could educate me on thinking that they're stronger than what I've been told.
Sure. Some of them are that way. Most ribbons, if you lay them down flat, give them a half a year and they're going to be stretched out.
Oh, okay.
Because the way ribbons are corrugated, they're put between some gears with glassine paper on the two sides. So they end up with a fairly wavy shape to them, which gives them that elasticity. What Rick Parada did at Royer was he designed these corrugators that run about $6,000 a pop. But they're so fine-tuned and the gears are so stable that you can run the ribbon material directly through them. Now, this is material that, you know, you take 60 of these ribbons and stack them up, you know, push them together, and you've got about the width of a human hair. So this is a very fine material, super fine. And so you can run with Royers, we run them through the corrugators directly, and they take the shape of the gears. And with any kind of metal, when you bend it, you get what's called work hardening. When you work the metal, it toughens the metal. Same thing with even this ribbon that's so light, it'll literally float. It'll float upwards and stick to the ceiling if there's any static electricity in the room. But you work harden it there, and you hang it in this in its transducer at the top and bottom, and they can really take a beating.
Hmm.
These rhythms, you can put them on an electric guitar cab. Joe Perry's been using them in the studio and live for the last 10 or 11 years. Wow. Has six ribbons on the road, five are on the cabs, one's on standby, and they've blown one in 11 years.
Wow.
Yeah. They send them in occasionally to say, hey, you know, go through these, and we'll re-ribbon them for the guys. You know, you can tell if they're loosening up at all by testing them electronically, but they're pretty tough. But again, like you were just saying, they give them to a two-year-old and they sneeze into them or drop them on the floor and you could have a problem.
Yeah, yeah. We've always shied away from using it on vocals for that reason, just because I didn't, you know, want somebody to do one false heavy breath or something and destroy the mic.
Exactly. But as far as storing them, the old ribbons, you don't want to lay them down. Royers, I have some at home that from the first 10, that I've got a couple there that have sat on their side for 15 years now. And we tested them recently. They're fine.
And do they? Yeah. Does each mic sound different, would you say, or there's a consistency?
Ribbons by model are very consistent. Mm. And Royers are extremely consistent. The other line that is excellent and extremely consistent is AA. They really each of their mics are very consistent model to model. There are some others that aren't so consistent. Some of the stuff coming out of China is just there's no testing. There's
I
no
can
quality
totally
control.
Attest to that. As a man who has probably more cheap Chinese microphones than anybody you will ever meet. Just so you know, I go to the NAMM show, and usually the last day I head down to the hall downstairs.
Yeah, bargain basement, right.
And I pick up microphones because I like to take them apart and use them. And you know what? I get some pretty decent condenser microphones. I actually do. As a matter of fact, I'm using one right now. But the ribbons, you guys have nothing to worry about when it comes to their ribbon microphones.
So you mentioned Eddie Kramer before, and the way he mic'd or that he used a ribbon on Hendrix. He showed me how he mic'd Hendrix once upon a time. Yes. And it's a fairly bizarre scheme, very complex, actually. It's a cluster of three microphones, an M160, a Beyer M160 ribbon, a 421, and an SM57 in a cluster up against the cabinet. And then about 3 feet back, it's a U87 or U67.
Mm-hmm.
And then about 3 feet back from that, it was a stereo mic of whatever kind you could get.
Wow. Wow.
So it was, you know, basically it was, you know, those six channels. Plus, he absolutely positively had to have a plate, a 140. So he had eight channels that will come back. And that's basically, you know, Jimmy's sound. So I was actually playing on a session when he showed me this, and he was miking me up. And I was playing in the control room. One of the interesting things about Eddie is, you know, a lot of engineers, they'll put the faders up, they'll get a sound, they'll leave it. Eddie is one of those guys that he's constantly mixing while you're recording. The faders are always being moved, and he's always, you know, doing these small incremental little balances, you know. But that's what he used in order to do it.
Man, according I'd love to see that.
Yeah.
That's pretty awesome. And you know what? There wasn't a cheap Chinese microphone in that whole cluster, was there?
It's straight nuts.
So, your manufacturing process is really specific. You get great microphones. One mic that I want to ask you about is the stereo ribbon microphone that you guys make. That intrigues me. How is that used? What's a really good use for that microphone?
Wow. There are such great uses. We have a number of samples up on Royer's site.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the mind-blowing ones is an SF-12, which is a passive stereo ribbon microphone over a full orchestra, the Ukrainian radio television orchestra in the Ukraine. This engineer showed up with a contract to record a 100-piece orchestra. This is a recording of Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet.
Right.
And he showed up with one mic, and they weren't really happy with it. But after the recording was done and they heard it, they've invited him back a number of times. And this guy shows up with his one stereo mic, and it's a big part of what he does because – if you get yourself in a room where you right. really like the sound of something and you put the right stereo mic right. there, you can get that sound. And
see, that's what I would think. I would think that would be.
See, this is a case where he should have showed up with a dozen of them. Only used the one.
Yeah, right. That would be awesome.
Well, how directional are ribbon mics?
Yeah.
The directionality is pretty fantastic. They're figure eight, and they are naturally figure eight. They hear from the front and they hear from the back. They do not hear from the top and bottom, and they don't hear from the sides. So you can use the rejection from the sides to really kill bleed. Matter of fact, the reason Joe Perry started using the 121s on the road was he was having a bleed issue. And a fella told him, a friend of ours, said, hey, dude, put 121s up and you'll kill the bleed. And it did. So he goes, oh, great, because they had just done just push play, and they wanted to use the 121. Like he had in the studio. So he goes, oh, you can't use these on the road. And the guy said, why not? You know, just take good care of them like you would in the studio. And they do take good care of the mics.
So the sides just fall off then?
The sides fall off. Yeah. And you've got the backside open, but if your gain level, if your gain structure right. is set for the front side, which is blasting,
right?
Imagine how little is going to get in the back. Yeah. Practically nothing. I mean, you could have a monitor 3 feet away screaming up that way. It's not going to hear it. Because it's sitting there 2 inches from a speaker.
Right.
You know, and that's what your gain structure is set for. So
that's awesome. That's fantastic.
It is. And you can change a figure eight's pattern. You can, but you have to do it physically. I'm talking about a ribbon mic. You'd have to build literally a structure behind it to kill what's coming in the backside. There was there was one ribbon that RCA made that basically had a labyrinth in the back with horsehair in it. And that would kill sound on the backside pretty well. Sounded pretty good.
Now, let me ask you about one of the most misunderstood aspects of ribbon, and that's ribbons and mics and phantom power.
Aha. Okay.
Tell us all about it.
Okay. Well, there were a couple of ribbons early on that were not well designed. We're talking back in the 50s here, 40s. That if you plug them in and you flip the phantom power switch, the ribbon would blow like a fuse. However, most ribbons, if your cable is properly wired, you can flip phantom off and on all day long, and the phantom will never get to the ribbon. It's if you have a miswired cable that you can send phantom up to the ribbon. The place where phantom does most damage, and people don't realize this, is when you're coming in and out of a patch bay. If you've got a TT patch bay, you're momentarily shorting tip to ring and then tip to sleeve, throwing a little bit of phantom up the line, and that ribbon will just kind of bounce in response to the phantom hitting. Now, the durability of the ribbon, this is where this really comes in. You can do that to a 121 a number of times and really not damage it. Some other ribbons, 30, 40 different insertions into a patch bay are going to start wearing that ribbon out.
Or a cheap Chinese ribbon microphone. Not that ever happened. Okay, it did happen.
But interestingly, a lot of those cheap Chinese mics have such thick ribbons on them. It's easier to work with. You just throw. We opened up one of these mics, and the ribbon material was so thick, you could hold it sideways, and it just stayed there. But the thing is, the mic was completely blown when we opened it, and we bought it new. And what had happened was apparently somebody had decided to clean the mic with an air compressor. Great, okay. All right, right. Now, just see the end of the line. Okay, let's clean this. There we go. All right. Now I'll send it off to the U.S. and
wait. So I may not have blown my mic.
You may not have. You probably did.
It may have arrived.
So I have a good phantom power story. So Royer makes passive and active ribbon mics. I guess the only manufacturer that makes active ribbon mics, right?
Well, a lot of them are into that game now, but we started it.
Yeah.
We did the first couple of them.
So Don was kind enough to lend me an SF-24, I guess, for a session I was doing. And second engineer, the assistant engineer, plugged the mic in. It's stereo, so he plugged it in, and one of the channels had phantom on. And I turned around and looked, and I went white. I thought, oh, God, I blew this microphone up. And then, of course, when we listened, one side was active, could hear one side, and the other side was not. And I thought, oh, God. So I told him, okay, pull it down. and we did something else. So a couple of days later, I'm back to John, and I said, oh, I'm sorry, I think I blew up your microphone here. And he said, well, what did you do? I said, well, there's phantom power on one side and not on the other. And he says, well, yeah, that's because it needed phantom power on that side. Sure. So it turns out that the side that had phantom power was the one that I was hearing.
We have had that happen. We literally had a guy call in one day who had a pair of 122s, which are phantom powered ribbon mics. And he called, I said, I'm getting no sound out of these. And I said, well, did you turn the phantom on? He goes, well, no, because these are you know, ribbons. And I said, yeah, but these are phantom power ribbons. He goes, I know. I said, well, tell you what, you go ahead and you turn that phantom power and I'll be on the phone with you. He goes, okay, all right. And he's really nervous. And you click the phantom. He's like, oh, wow. You know?
I know.
See, they work. It's cool.
Well, you know, I can understand that, though, because, you know, phantom – I mean, ribbon mics are kind of – the most misunderstood mics. They're like the black box of microphones, you know, and at least, and that was the way, you know, I really kind of educated myself buying a ton of these Chinese ribbon microphones because I knew what to do and what not to do. But phantom power, you know, I'd be reluctant to shoot some voltage, 48 volts.
Yeah, but tell them about there's a YouTube movie that shows, was it Shiny Box?
Yeah, Shiny Box, yeah. There's a great video up there about phantom power, and they literally have this ribbon transducer sitting out there, and they flip in phantom off and on. And you see it doesn't budge. Hmm. But then he's sort of showing what would happen going through a TT patch bay, and you watch that ribbon bounce. So anybody can look up the Shiny Box video on phantom power, and you'll see it clearly. It's a great video.
One of the things that John showed me when I was first checking out the Roy ribbons was that you need to have, if you're going to use the non-phantom power one, you have to really have a good sensitive mic pre.
Yes.
You can't just plug a 121 into an El Cheapo horrible mic pre and expect it to sound great.
Well, it's because
it has to be very sensitive.
The ribbons just by nature have a lower output because, you know, and that's why you make them active so that you don't have to worry about that, right?
Right. The active ribbons are at the level of a modern condenser mic, a phantom power condenser mic. But the non-powered ribbons are 15 to 20 dB less sensitive than that. And when we got started, a lot of pre's were, you know, in the 50 dB gain area, maybe 55, 60 was hot. These days, you see a lot of pre's with 70 to 80 dB of gain, and that's kind of normal now because there's so many more ribbons in the game. And Millennium makes their pre's. Now you can ask them for a ribbon mod on all the inputs, and it's free. They just change it up a little bit, give you, I think, another 10 dB a level, and it's a good, clean level.
Let me ask you a question. With all the different microphones that you guys make, if you were going to give some advice, I mean, where would be a good place to start for someone who's building up their microphone collections and wants to have just a good ribbon mic?
That's a great question. The 121 is a really good place to start. And we have another mic that costs $500 less than the 121. And that's called the 101. And it's almost as good a microphone. It's a great mic. It's a bigger microphone. It's not quite as hi-fi sounding if you listen to the two side-by-side, but if you go on Royer's website and go to the 101 page, we've done a number of samples, some down at Capitol on piano and acoustic guitar and trumpet, and then some at Joe Barisi's place with the two different mics on the same guitar cabinet, and you can hear the difference between the two. And so it's a very close mic, but if you're an electric guitarist, get a ribbon and just put it on your cabinet, but get a good one. Get a decent ribbon and put it up on your cab. If you want more aggression, you put a 57 next to it, and you use the two in balance to, you know, dial in more aggression, more of those aggressive highs from the 57. But a good ribbon will give you all that mid-range, all that low-end, all that oomph. Carlos Santana discovered the one – his engineer put some 121s up on him years ago, just after that big hit with Rob Thomas Smooth. You can really hear the difference in the tone. You hear this kind of gushy stuff happening from his speakers, very much like what was happening in front of the guitar cabinet. So electric guitars, try them in different places on the amp. You can go to Recording Tips on our website and find all sorts of different positions to work with. Same with drums, same with brass. I mean, brass, it just sounds so natural. And this takes me back to something we were talking about earlier in the conversation, and that's that we were saying some instruments are so sibilant. and so harsh. It's really not that those instruments are so harsh. I've stood in front of big band brass sections, and they sound incredible. They're really powerful and very bright, but not harsh, very musical. It's when you go in the control room that you're listening to something that's very harsh.
You know what? You know? That's a great point. It's the microphone interpretation of whatever that is that
yes.
adds that harshness to it.
But that's because people will put a condenser mic up on brass, and the resonant point or where it takes a little bump is just – where you get the resonant point on the horn as well, on the brass as well. So, of course, it's going to accentuate.
Yeah, that's true.
Exactly.
Right there, 1K.
It's going to accentuate, and you're going to go, oh, it's ripping my head off. Man, brass is killing me. But listen to that brass by itself. Listen to a section or listen to a great trumpet player, and there's so much tone and there's so much body, and the highs are beautiful. It's just when you go back in the control room that you go, oh, my God.
Which brings you back to your original point of they hear kind of like the way
you're like
ear,
your ears, yeah.
Your ears here.
How many mics do you make?
Eight.
Okay.
Yeah. Eight, and then a few of those are also made in live versions with slightly thicker ribbons. Okay. But, you know, going back to this, the way things sound different in the control room, listen to a violin. A violin is such a beautiful instrument, especially a good one and a good player. But you can stand there and listen to it, and then you can go in the control room, and you're hearing the rosin. Right. And it's going, yeah. And you're hearing the highs start to sound more piercing. And,
yeah.
But that's not the way that instrument sounds.
No, that's
it's
right.
The microphone choice, and you can hardly find a condenser in the world that's not going to do that because they all have high-end bump built into them. In days prior to digital recording, you had tape kind of softening and compressing that a little bit, and it's a very good blend, condensers and tape. But when you got into the digital world, things were becoming more clinical. You didn't have that natural process of making things a little sweeter. Mm-hmm. So you're really hearing what a condenser is doing to certain frequencies on certain instruments. And it's not that the instruments are harsh. It's just the way the mics are hearing them.
Right.
So, again, when you want something to sound the way it really sounds in the room, you go to a ribbon and you can really get the job done. It's a beautiful experience.
You know, I just think it's fantastic how as digital and recording starts getting better and better and cleaner, you know, classic analog, you know, good ribbon microphone, you know, good mic pre. It's just so important.
But you know what's interesting about all this is, as you say, David Royer and you and everybody else within Royer, the Royer Company, is responsible for bringing the sound of ribbons back.
Yeah.
Because they had fallen into disfavor primarily because of broadcast.
Exactly.
It's because they were so big that they looked bad on camera, so they went to smaller condenser
right.
mics at the time and that were, you know, a little less obtrusive. And boy, they were giving those things away for a while, throwing them
you
in the dumpster.
Find them in the dumpster,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, people were just kind of afraid of them because of the reputation as well, that, you know, they were fragile and everything. And congratulations for bringing it back. And actually, now, again, the 121 is a standard. It's a staple. And you can't say that about many microphones. You guys should be congratulated for actually bringing a microphone into the consciousness, recording consciousness, as a standard in such a short period of time, because it usually doesn't happen that way.
Thank you. And really, one of the things we had going for our favor, obviously, was the switch to digital right at that time, but also being right here in L.A., I mean, Royer's in Burbank.
Right.
And I used to run down to Capitol all the time. There's a big session. I was down there with a box of mics. And Al Schmidt picked them up really quickly and of course, knew right where he wanted to put them because his ears are so great. And all these other engineers would come over and look at what he was doing. Hey, you know, I'd like to try that myself.
Yeah.
Jeff Remerick, you know, remember him coming over and looking at a big band thing that was going on where Al had ribbons all over this Arturo Sandoval session. And then, you know, Jeff's asked me to bring down some mics. And,
wow.
And you know, a number of other engineers picked it up that way, word of mouth. Jerry Hay and Gary Grant, who's got incredible ears, these guys came by and one day brought about 15 guys by Royer's shop. These are very early days. And
That's the A-team horn players.
Yeah.
And that is how I found out about it. Gary Grant came to my place to do a session and had brought the 121 with him to use on his trumpet. And then that was it. And then I called you shortly after that. That's the first time we met. It was because of Gary.
And you know what? Let me give a little bit of props to your marketing team, because the Royer ad was the same ad all the time. It was very consistent. That long strip that you would always have. You would always see whatever publication, you know, whether you're Mix Magazine or whatever. You always see the Royer ad. I mean, you did the same thing all the time, but. there was a certain familiarity, and it was very consistent. And you start paying attention to that, and then people are like, "Yeah, you got
the microphone." It really showcased how the microphone looked as well.
It
did. How streamlined it was, and how original it was.
It's definitely not bulky.
Yeah,
it was cool looking.
You know, I've got to give props to George Peterson, the former editor of Mix Magazine. He's with, what's the magazine now, Live Sound?
Live Sound.
Yeah. Brilliant guy. And he in our very early days, said, "Hey, John, you know, you're talking about this half page, but why don't you do a third page vertical? Because then you can be the only vertical on the page, and it's a vertical product.
Yep.
You can really show that mic." I was like, "George, thank you."
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it was his idea, and it was like, you listen to a great idea, and you run with it.
Yeah.
Well, it worked.
So, and that way, if it's a vertical ad, the ribbon doesn't stretch either.
Yeah. I mean, I can't think of another ad, but I can definitely, I remember. You just got that.
I took a little while there, right? Yeah. Wow. That's latency right there.
That was 42 milliseconds.
Yeah, well, that's 420 milliseconds.
Well, hey, listen, we gotta wrap this up, but...
Well, why don't we then?
Wow. Wow.
Come on, somebody's got to say it, wrap it up with a ribbon. Right out, wink.
But John, thank you so much for joining us. I mean, it was fantastic. I learned a ton, and I know you've answered a lot of questions, and you've kind of, you know, educated us on the ribbon microphone. And the best thing I can say about it is, you know, I'm not afraid anymore.
Good.
I am not afraid.
Do not be afraid.
And actually, I want to encourage you out there. You know, you're looking for a microphone. You want to add something to your arsenal to really make you pop. I mean, this is going to be it. If everybody in your area is, you know, touting the latest, greatest condenser, you show up on that session with a good ribbon microphone and put on the guitars, and you're going to get called back. And that's the name of the game is you know, getting that next sec. That next session, just keeping moving forward, using the right tools. Anything else you want to wrap up with, anything, John? I'm going to give you the last word on your ribbon microphones.
Well, I was just going to say, going along with what you just said, you know, a musician shows up for a gig, and you've really spent, you know, how many hours learning your craft, and you spent how much money on your rig, you know, what your guitar, your amp, your trumpet, your violin, your whatever you're into playing, your drum set. If you can show up and give somebody some tips on miking it, they're going to help. Some engineers might have an ego about that, but a lot of folks, if you bring in a Royer or an AA ribbon, you know, something that they've heard about, they're going to go, "Oh, okay, cool, we'll try that out." If you know where to position it, you're helping capture that sound of yours. You know, why invest so much time and then go someplace and not be able to capture what it is that you're producing? I think it's one of the greatest things for a musician to put a good ribbon up on your instrument and really capture that sound. I mean, I've seen world-class musicians just crying they've heard a good ribbon. I was on a session with Gail Levant, the great L.A. harp player who's played on, you know, thousands of movies and tons of records. And first time she heard her harp tracked on some ribbons, which is on the first Royer demo CD, which is up on our website too, she just broke down in tears and said, "I've never heard this sound the way it sounds in the room." If you can capture that sound, you're doing yourself a big favor. And this isn't a Royer commercial here. This is a ribbon thing. You know, use a ribbon to your advantage and really get the sound of that instrument that you're tracking, and you go a long way toward bringing, you know, musicality back into this thing.
I think what you said, what's attractive about it as well, is the warmth that we don't always hear on digital.
Right.
That's what attracts me, is that you can be looking at something that's going to give it the depth that you don't usually get.
Right, and you have a lot of warmth and depth in front of all these instruments we're talking about.
Yeah.
Go get it.
Yeah.
You know, a ribbon will get you there.
Awesome. That is awesome. And, you know, on a purely just selfish level, you know, all the engineers that you were talking about, all the producers, you know, these guys don't suck. So
no, they're quite excellent.
Use the tools that they use, and just by association, you're going to sound a little bit better because you know, use their tools. Anyhow, well, thank you, John. I really appreciate you coming here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Spread the word.
Really appreciate it.
And, you know, go, you know, this thing could be a Royer commercial because the microphones are that good and they're staples. And I believe it's important for us to promote, you know, products that are good and promote products that are going to make people good. You know, they're going to help you out with your own career. It's hard enough making a living out there. If you can find a tool to give you an edge, that's more power to you. Well, hey, listen, we're going to wrap up. I want to encourage everybody out there to go ahead and send us an email if you want to be in the API giveaway. Like I said, we are, you know, there's, considering the amount of people that have downloaded the last show, and by the way, you know, our website went down. You blew us up. Exceeded bandwidth. But no, it's really great. And like I said at the top of the show, it's really great that you guys are responding. So go ahead, send us an email, put API or giveaway. It's funny, on Larry's message, he says, say API. And then on the podcast, I say, put giveaway.
So, either one.
So I'm getting a lot of API giveaway, a lot of giveaway APIs. And if you're going to enter more than one time, odds are I'm going to catch you. I literally am reading every single one of these. So
We really appreciate when you write something meaningful there. So they all get read.
Yes, they do. They all get great, great, great comments. The number one request. You guys want to know what the number one request for us?
Probably want to know what you're wearing.
That's number two. No, the number one is the they want more podcasts.
Wow.
And but you know we used to do it every other week. It's, and I'll be honest with you guys, it's tough. You know, we're, one thing that makes our podcast so good is everybody that's on the panel, we're all professionals, we're all working, and we're all doing pretty good at what we're doing. And unfortunately, the podcast, you know, we try to squeeze it in. And even today, you know, you got Scott who's on the stage and Diego's flying back. And I mean, the people are working. So
Bobby's playing soccer. I mean, these are busy people.
That's right. So, you know, we'll try, but I'm all into doing better quality shows than just putting up a bunch of shows up there just for the sake of having a bunch of shows. I mean, to be honest, none of these guys really knew, you know, the podcast is locked before. You know, until like, you know, a couple days beforehand when I send out the, okay, we're podcasting. So we're kind of all like on standby, you know. It's Matt, for Rob, it was today when, you know, he finally, like, it was confirmed. But
yeah, well, that's okay.
But so just so you know, we're going to do at least one a month. We'll try to do more than that if we can do it. But we appreciate all your comments. So before we go, Rob, you working on anything that you want to talk about? Anything fun and exciting?
Just a lot of projects in progress. Yeah, I have. Well, yeah, we'll talk about it next time. Okay. I'm doing some crazy things that aren't secret, but would take too long to go into right now.
Alrighty, John, you want to just any like the new Royer mic? What's one thing you can, you know, anything you want to promote? This is a time for the commercial.
Well, actually, you know, I'll tell you a little Royer secret. Rick Parada is a good engineer in his own rights. Him and Dave Royer have worked on a number of these things together. And he fleshes Dave's ideas out. But if Rick, if
is that me? Just got Caribbean.
That's you.
Wow. Oh, no wonder.
He said, "Don't talk about
me." Finger off, right? I'm getting a message from God. Oh. Now, if Rick comes in and says, "Hey, I just got this. I had this great idea in the shower this morning." You go, "Oh, okay," because Rick's shower ideas are the best. I don't know what's going on there, but he came in with this idea a few years ago of a different way of making a shock mount that didn't involve any rubber parts, no bungee cable, no nothing like that. And it developed out into this shock we call a sling shock, which you can see on the website if you'd like. And we literally just this past week heard that we're going to get the patent on this thing.
Okay.
That
awesome.
We've been applying for.
Wow.
And it's, yeah, I think we'll end up licensing this out to other companies who can make them much more efficiently, but get everybody, get people off these bungee cords that, you know, I don't know, a lot of folks might wonder why their shock mounts are kind of relaxing and giving up the ghost over time. A lot of times it's because of these air purifiers. You know, negative ion generators will just eat rubber. People end up with these shock mounts that have just caved in.
Right.
What's the matter with this thing? I need to get more cords. It's a real problem. So anyway, it's a great shock mount. You might want to take a look at that.
I'm actually looking at it right now. It looks pretty darn impressive, if I may say so. Doesn't look like anything I've seen before. So
cool. And the only other thing I'd like to give a quick shout out to is Mojave Audio is Dave Royer's condenser microphone company. And there's some really wonderful stuff there. The site is loaded with audio examples and videos if you want to take a look at some very nice stuff.
And we've had Dusty on our show.
Oh, you have?
A couple times, yeah.
Okay, yeah, Dusty's great.
Yeah, he's a great guy. We like Mojave. We're big fans of the audio.
Cool.
Bobby O.
Well, as always, there's lots of stuff going on, more than I can probably talk about at once. But the one thing I want to mention is I've been asked to become a contributor to Forbes, analyzing the new music business.
Wow.
So you can check out, and actually they're kind of think pieces, so every other day or so I'm posting something up there.
You know what? And really quick, we were supposed to get into this, but we're going to do this next time because this will affect a lot of our listeners. But from what you were saying about the interns, how they
the ruling about interns and unpaid internships.
That's a little tease for next time. We're going to talk a little bit about that because that's going to affect literally a ton of our audience. Pagey boy.
Well, my big thing is to get into Forbes. That's all I want to get. Yeah, I just want to mention in this write-up somewhere. I know.
Well, you know somebody now. It's very cool. It's all you know.
I'm edging up closer to him. No, I'm doing what I always do, writing songs. Yeah. It's as simple as that, and I just feel very, very lucky to still be doing it. So that's as simple as that, writing a new song every week and enjoying it.
I'm going to give a quick plug. I had dinner with Martin a few weeks ago, and he played me some of the stuff he's working on, and it's fantastic.
You were drunk at the time.
No, it's really good, and I don't want to put any pressure on, because people are going to say, oh, we want to hear it, but it is probably some of your best that I've ever heard. It's really good, so I'm going to tease that, but it's really good.
How about you, Mike?
I got a great gig, and I can't talk about it as much as I want to.
I'm not losing you, am I?
No. I'm going to be mixing. I'm going back to TV, and I've actually landed a really good animation gig that I'm going to be mixing, and that's going to be really fun. It's an insane time frame for what they want to do. So I'm working on my template. And I'm just customizing the bejeebies out of it because not only do I got to mix it, but I got to do sound design on the thing also. A lot of the sound design is coming to me already. But, when they need a little bit of help, they want some sound design. And I just want to, give them some really good sounds and stuff. So these are all the battles that you're going to win when you're just set up with a really great template that just makes your workflow get from point A to point B just really smooth. Because, when you're mixing, especially for animation, it's all about the sound. I mean, the sound really creates the environment. What you see and what you hear, literally you can change the story by what it sounds like.
Yeah.
And when you're mixing for animation, it's not just, for instance, if they're in a cave and you're talking, well, obviously you got to have reverb on the voice. But you know what? If they kick a rock or if anything happens out there, you got to place that sound effect in the same environment that, the dialogue is in. I mean, all has to sound like it's coming from the same place. So you're just setting yourself up. And I'm working on a really, really great template right now. And it's going to be fun. I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be a little hairy. But as soon as the first couple air, then I'll go ahead and tell you what I'm doing. But until then, it's top secret.
Oh. We're very good at that, aren't we?
I know. Yeah. I know.
Can't talk about it. It's very James Bond every week.
Well, hey, listen, totally appreciate you guys being with us here today. Thank you so much, John.
Yes, John. My pleasure. Thank you for having me. Really
and,
appreciate it.
As we start year eight, can you imagine that? Year eight.
Wow.
This is year eight. So if you have any comments or questions.
That's
right.
Eight, yeah.
If you have any comments or questions, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And, if you send it as a email, we're going to enter you in the contest whether you want to be or not. you can also check out our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/audionowcast. All right. Well, for myself and all the guys, thank you so much for listening. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and West Wave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez and uses AFEX's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.